she leads a very encrypted life. So she sent her public encryption key to Snowden, and then once he had really secure communication set up with her, he said, "This is what I know, and I can prove it."
NSA leaker Edward Snowden demanded the highest security before spilling his secrets about America's national security apparatus. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Qatar-based Al Jazeera is poised to launch a new American-based channel, but will Americans watch?
Some segment of the population that are bigoted and biased are always going to look upon them with suspicion.
And Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Paul Salopek is tracing the steps of our human ancestors from Africa to South America, reporting things you can only learn on foot.
They looked at me as if I was stupid, because what they were walking along were invisible boundaries of conflict that only they and their enemies could see.
All that and more coming up next.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It's partly because of this New York Times op doc, that is, documentary, that you're hearing now, posted exactly a year ago, that Edward Snowden leaked his story about massive NSA data collection to Guardian columnist Glenn Greenwald and his mostly silent partner, filmmaker Laura Poitras. It's a film she made of the NSA veteran-turned-whistleblower William Binney.
After 9/11, they took one of the programs I had done, or the back-end part of it, and started to use it to spy on everybody in this country.
Glenn Greenwald calls Poitras completely ubiquitous yet invisible in the reporting of the Snowden leaks. It was her clear opposition to government surveillance and her encryption know-how that led Snowden to trust her. Because of reporting in Iraq, Poitras was subject to regular detentions and intensive airport searches. So to protect her sources, she began to wipe her computers and cell phones clean and encrypt her data. In this weekend's New York Times Magazine, reporter Peter Moss says that Poitras actually wasn't Edward Snowden's first choice.
Well, first he reached out to Glenn Greenwald, and he sent Glenn a link to an instruction manual of how to do encryption, and Glenn kind of blew that off. And then he sent Glenn a link to a video on how to do encryption, and Glenn also blew that off. And I talked to Glenn about that, and Glenn said, yeah, you know, this stuff, it's just confusing, it's difficult, I didn't have the time for it. He just got tired of harassing me, and so then he went to Laura, and he sends an email anonymously to Laura saying, I need to communicate with you with encryption, can I have your public encryption key? And she leads a very encrypted life. So she sent her public encryption key to Snowden, and then he got back to her with encrypted emails saying, okay, now we need to step it up yet another level or two. Once he had really secure communication set up with her, he said, this is what I know, and I can prove it.
So all that before actually sharing any information, how long before he shared his name?
She did not know his name, age, gender, or even where he worked until very late in the game. And she was, in fact, very cautious. She knew when she got this first email, if indeed what this person was telling her was true, that this was amazing and that her life would change. But she did not know, A, whether it was true, could be a crackpot, or B, whether it was, for example, a government agent trying to entrap her. So either path that she went was incredibly perilous.
Do you think that the way that Poitras handled Snowden's security ought to be the new standard for how journalists should handle any source that puts him or herself at risk? And do you think it's even really possible?
What Poitras did is indeed the standard that journalists must aspire to, because if you want to protect your sources, you have to provide them secure means to do so, which also means the sources have to be able to participate in that. Encryption only works if both parties are encrypting. Now, for other journalists, it might not be necessary to kind of reach these very high levels. I'm not just talking about plain vanilla encryption, but having air-gapped computers when you view the documents, et cetera, et cetera. But it's necessary.
Air-gapped computers are computers that are not connected to the internet.
Exactly. So one of the extra measures that Laura took was to transfer the information, the sensitive information, to a computer that was air-gapped. It wasn't simply not connected to the internet. It had never been connected to the internet. So there was no possibility or extremely remote possibility that somebody had put some malware on it in order to read what was on it. And that's the computer on which she would read and work on the documents that she was given.
When Greenwald and Poitras started publishing Snowden's story, many people wondered why Snowden had gone to them rather than to more established figures in national security reporting. And you say part of the reason was that he believed that they wouldn't hold the story. The New York Times held its warrantless wiretapping story for a year, and that actually gave him the willies. Does the direction that Snowden ultimately took have implications for the rest of journalism?
What this means is that there is a new role for journalists who are not part of the established major media. And yes, Laura's won a MacArthur Genius Award. She's won a Peabody Award. She was nominated for an Academy Award. But she is not part of any major institution. And as far as Glenn's concerned, yes, he has The Guardian. But again, that's not the same clout as the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post. Sources actually may prefer to go to them, not despite the fact that they're outside these major institutions, but because they're outside these major institutions. What Snowden said is that it was because they had been very vocal and straightforward about their views on the surveillance state, and because they could not be controlled by a major media organization, that he went to them because he wanted to be sure that if he took the risk that he was going to take, I mean, risking his life to give them this information, that they would publish it.
Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter Maas is an investigative reporter who is working on a book now about surveillance and privacy for Alfred Knopf. So the way that Edward Snowden likely ended up communicating with journalists was an email encryption program called PGP, an acronym that means pretty good privacy. Gawker's Adrian Chen says that every journalist should use this, quote, annoying technology. Chen recently wrote about his own problems with setting up PGP. Adrian, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So what exactly is pretty good privacy?
It basically allows people to exchange emails that are completely garbled until they're downloaded, and then they can decrypt them on their computer. So the actual emails that are on, you know, Google's server are just gibberish, and even if government or law enforcement gets them, they won't be able to read them.
And so what makes it so annoying?
You have to download the software. What I used was called NewPG, which is an open source program, and it seems deceptively simple at first, but one of the biggest things was just small differences between what was going on my computer and what was going on in the instructions. So I had a slightly different icon or options on a menu, and so then it takes an hour to realize, oh, I have the wrong version of this software and I have to update it. And so you have to do that over and over again, you know, and it can get pretty tedious.
So how are journalists going to learn how to use this stuff? Is there a class you can sign up for?
Well, there are a lot of guides online. One of the best is actually from the Freedom of the Press Foundation. But I don't think it's going to be really widespread until it doesn't require 4 hours of somebody's time to install.
So where does that leave us?
The big push is for kind of more user-friendly things that people can just plug and play. The problem is there's been a number of high-profile snafus with these new technologies. The Tor browser is one of the popular ones that was just revealed to have had some kind of bug that let presumably the feds look into users' activity on it.
Tor is like the first name in cybersecurity, right?
Right. And so user-friendliness is often traded off with security. And so I think the key is just going to be finding the right balance.
Soon after we learned about a lot of the government's intrusions into everybody's data traffic, we talked to somebody about how to safeguard one's communications. And he suggests snail mail.
I think that's probably the safest way, or meeting in a parking garage. There's no way you can completely secure your communications, and there's just an infinite amount of things that can go wrong.
Adrian, you mentioned in your article that you'd had a bit to drink when you started trying to figure this PGP software out. Do you think that actually hindered, or maybe did it help?
I think it greased the wheels for sure. They should probably put that in the instructions just to keep you from destroying your computer in the process.
Adrian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Adrian Chen is a staff writer for Gawker.
Two years ago, NPR aired a heartbreaking series on government failures in child welfare on South Dakota Indian reservations. Reporter Laura Sullivan's stories on All Things Considered specifically concerned the removal of Native American children from their families and placement in foster care in white homes. Over the course of three broadcasts, listeners were painted a picture of a state bureaucracy acting unlawfully and cruelly for the most venal of motives, federal dollars.
Every time a state puts a child in foster care, the federal government sends money. Because South Dakota is poor, it sends lots of money.
Kids being taken out of families, families are being disrupted because the money was there.
I couldn't imagine what they tell these kids about where they come from and who they are. It's kidnapping.
Kidnapping. That's a provocative characterization. And the state of South Dakota was duly provoked. Dollar amounts were exaggerated, they complained, and statistics cited out of context. The role of the tribes themselves in foster placements was all but ignored, they said, as was the critical shortage of Native American families qualified and willing to accept foster children. Each placement of a child did not enrich the state, they said, but rather cost it money. And most of all, they said, the series gave short shrift to the overwhelming reality of child neglect stemming from poverty's grimmest pathologies. The complaints got the attention of NPR's ombudsman, Edward Schumacher Matos, who spent a year and a half investigating them. His 80-page report, released this month, was withering. He found errors in fact, one-sided reporting, and devastating but poorly contextualized personal testimony, leading listeners to only one conclusion: systemic failure based on cultural insensitivity and greed. Here he was Monday speaking with NPR's media reporter David Folkenflik on All Things Considered.
It added up to a deeply flawed report that shouldn't have aired as it was.
Schumacher Matos, reporter Laura Sullivan, and NPR news management all declined interview requests from On the Media. In a prepared statement, NPR's chief content officer Kinsey Wilson and senior vice president for news Margaret Lowe Smith acknowledged some flaws with the series, but they criticized Schumacher Matos in terms strikingly similar to his own. Quote, "Overall, the process surrounding the ombudsman's inquiry was unorthodox, the sourcing selective, the fact-gathering uneven, and many of the conclusions, in our judgment, subjective or without foundation. For that reason, we've concluded there is little to be gained from a point-by-point response to his claims." Wrong answer. When a national news organization invites listeners to believe a government is kidnapping children, and the audience's representative cites eye-popping specifics, agree to disagree is an evasion of responsibility. In the face of the ombudsman's allegations, nothing less than point-by-point response will do.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In dubbing itself the worldwide leader in sports, ESPN made it clear it was shooting for big game. But initially, at least, it hunted the small stuff, like miniature golf and the world's strongest man competition.
The sixth event, the girl lift, and Ryan Hout responded to Wilhelm's victory in the wheelbarrow race. 790 pounds.
Now, of course, ESPN has bagged the behemoths, football, baseball, and basketball, and those have yielded huge audiences, huge ad revenue, and huge fees from cable providers who charge you $5 a month for ESPN, whether you watch sports or not. Today, ESPN is at least 20 times bigger than the New York Times Company and 5 times bigger than News Corp and the Wall Street Journal. You might have thought that media riches were driven by media niches, That's what Chris Anderson told us in his 2006 best-selling book, The Long Tail, Why the Future of Business is Selling Less of More. But as Derek Thompson explained in this month's Atlantic, ESPN flipped Anderson's long tail approach on its, quote, fat head.
The long tail was basically Chris Anderson's idea that when you look at companies like Amazon, they seem to make the majority of their money on this long tail of niche products that only a handful of consumers actually want. But there's so many of these niche products that it ends up being the majority of their business. But ESPN made the opposite bet, the fat head. They said, what we're going to do is we're going to spend a lot of our money to buy exclusive sports rights to the most popular sports. And it's paid off in the billions. Over the last decade, what we've seen in addition to it paying off for ESPN is that it appears to be paying off for all sorts of other industries as well.
Yeah, in your piece, you quote a Harvard Business School professor, Anita Elbers, who did a study that kind of contradicts everything in Chris Anderson's hypothesis about at least how media would work.
Look at summer blockbusters. Think about the biggest movies of this summer and the past five summers. They are sequels. They are adaptations. I don't know that John Skipper, who is the president of ESPN right now, thought about long tails or fat heads. He was just thinking, we want to maximize the odds that when someone turns on ESPN, that within 2 minutes, they'll see a sport that they love.
Now, one of the reasons ESPN has become such a juggernaut is that unlike most of everything else you find on TV, it is broadcasting a live event in real time.
If you don't have to watch it live, then it's hard for the advertisers to know exactly where you are and when you're watching. Something between 90 and 96% of all ESPN is watched live. So advertisers trust it, and it makes about $3 billion a year on advertising.
And yet, almost miraculously, had the category almost all to itself. Nobody on cable, at least, has bid against ESPN for these major sports contracts, at least until now.
ESPN is a little bit like Apple. It's making this extremely high-margin product, and eventually when people look at extremely profitable products, they say, we should probably get in on that. And the most recent entry into that field, one that launches in August, is Fox Sports One.
The Samsung of sports channels.
Right. The reason to think that they might be a real competitor to ESPN is that Fox Sports owns a lot of really valuable rights, baseball rights, football rights. And this is a company that's shown that it can really build audiences in whatever sort of entertainment sector it touches.
Got one more thing for you. It's true that ESPN, the mothership, does serve up the fathead, the big sports, but there's an ever-increasing number of spin-offs of ESPN showing so many obscure sporting events that it's been the stuff of cultural parody.
Live from Las Vegas, it's the Las Vegas International Dodgeball Open here on ESPN 8. The Ocho, bringing you the finest in seldom-seen sports from around the globe since 1999.
Yeah, that was the movie Dodgeball. Is ESPN really the fat head, or is it also the long tail, the whole damn comet?
I think it's fair to say this. In the process of becoming a fathead company, they have become so profitable that they can begin to invest in a long tail. And so they have ESPN3, which shows all sorts of completely obscure sports. They can have ESPN Classic and ESPN News. But those investments are only made possible by the success of their fathead strategy.
Derek, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Derek Thompson wrote about ESPN, the worldwide leader in sports, for this month's The Atlantic magazine.
So if ESPN's winning formula was to corner the market on the biggest sports, what's the recipe for 24-hour news? The opinionated Fox News is still on top, but this summer, the opinionated MSNBC lost its second-place position to longtime third-place CNN. Is news about niche programming, quality, or what? This week, a new 24-hour news channel will enter the market with the stated intention of bringing richer programming, less time-wasting piffle to the U.S. Al Jazeera, launched by the Emir of Qatar in 1996, already operates channels in Arabic and in English, both based in the Middle East. But now it wants to create a news channel headquartered in New York City with a distinctly American flavor. OTM producer Sarah Abdurrahman went inside Al Jazeera America to bring us a taste.
You may have heard the news back in January.
Al Jazeera is making a strong push for a wider American audience.
Al Gore officially sold his operation Current TV to Al Jazeera.
Al Jazeera plans to replace Current TV with its own English news network.
In America, it's the first new news channel launched since the mid-90s with Fox.
That last voice was Paul Edel, program director of the Al Jazeera English channel based in Doha. For the past 8 months, he's been working on the new American channel, slated to launch on Tuesday.
The studio used to be one of New York's most famous nightclubs in the 40s and 50s. And upstairs here used to be a derelict banking hall. It hadn't been used, I think, for 30 years. And we connected the two spaces and built a newsroom.
This latest addition to the Al Jazeera media empire aims to be an American channel for an American audience, anchored by its flagship weeknight show, America Tonight. Its senior executive producer, Kim Bondi, formerly of CNN, says it'll be a current affairs program with a focus on character-driven stories.
It has some of the sensibilities of CBS Sunday Morning. It should also look a little bit probably like Rock Center, and we're stealing a couple of pages out of Real Sports with Bryant Gumbel.
Another CNN transplant is Ali Velshi, the first big name to join the new network. He'll host a nightly show called Real Money and says if he had a dollar for every person that asked him why he took the job, he wouldn't even need it.
I'm a business reporter who has never had their hands in a business. So the idea that I could come here and leave an impression on this organization because I was here from day one was very, very exciting to me. This is not the glamorous life. This office that we're sitting in bears a striking resemblance to a jail cell. This is a startup.
On this day, Velshi is meeting with his producers, having just finished a mock run-through of his show.
At the top of the segment, mm-hmm. You want to try referring to them in the middle of the segment.
I think in this particular case, the top of the segment worked
okay.
Well.
Okay.
A lot of it is the director understanding how I point at things, where I'm going to stand, whether the monitor in which we're showing that graphic should be oriented as a portrait or as a landscape. As a landscape, which we did today, there's too much distance that I have to walk. We literally try the same block of news over and over again.
Is it kind of like rehearsing for a school play?
Exactly like rehearsing for a school play.
You nervous?
The excitement is an anesthetic to the nerves. I get down there for these rehearsals, and for a couple of minutes, I think this might actually be real, and then I get excited because I'm talking to my viewers.
But come Tuesday, will they have viewers? The biggest problem facing the new channel is that many Americans have already made up their minds about it.
I have to admit that when I hear about Al Jazeera, it does conjure up some negative images because of the whole terrorism in this country and all that.
It's Islamic affiliated, and it's very big and an important news source in the Middle East.
There are individuals who have been sought after. Their information could be broadcast through that station.
Is there any individual that comes to mind when you say that?
One individual who's not alive anymore. Bin Laden. His propaganda was filtered through that network.
I would acknowledge there is a perception, but I will tell you it's a perception, not reality.
Al Jazeera America CEO Ihab Al-Shahabi is convinced those perceptions will vanish once people try it out. He told me about an experiment Al Jazeera English conducted, playing the channel without its logo for a focus group.
And the focus group came very positive.
You took off the brand, people watched the product, and they liked it. Why not change the logo or do something that might differentiate it a little bit for people who might have that negative perception?
We thrive on our name. In 2010, it's been rated number 5 strongest brand in the world. So we are sticking with that brand.
I don't think you can ever distance yourself from someone who shares the same corporate parentage or name.
Velshi says he expects viewers will grow to accept the Al Jazeera name, but that right now Americans just aren't accustomed to Arabic products. He likens it to American attitudes toward Japanese cars in the 60s and 70s.
You were going to get in a lot of trouble from your neighbors if you pulled up in a Toyota or a Honda. We were not that far removed from a very bitter war with Japan. These people were considered enemies to many Americans. So it was culturally a problem. So when you look at Al Jazeera today, it's a lack of familiarity and a lot of Americans who think that we are culturally in a different place than a media organization based in the Middle East.
That base is Qatar, which bankrolls Al Jazeera, opening up the network to criticism that its editorial policy is too much aligned with Qatar's own interests. America Tonight's Kim Bondi says conflicts of interest are not unique to Al Jazeera.
What media organization has not had its own form of scrutiny in one way or the other about the stories that they cover? Media networks, you know, that can't do a critical story about a particular advertiser.
Even so, CEO Ihab El-Shehabi insists that there is no editorial influence from the network's funders.
There is a strong firewall between the government of Qatar and Al Jazeera.
I think you have to ask, well, what does the firewall consist of?
Politico's Blake Hounshell, former managing editor for Foreign Policy, has been told by Al Jazeera Arabic staffers and board members that there is editorial direction from the Qatari government, but it comes at a very high level.
It's not going to be, you know, people walking down to the newsroom and saying, okay, the emir wants you to do this and not that. It works, I think, a lot more subtly than that.
The direction might be subtle, but the outcome isn't always. Like when Al Jazeera became the de facto cheerleader for the Arab Spring.
During the Libyan uprising, there was this kind of musical introduction to all of their Libya coverage, and it was extremely over the top, really just propaganda, glorifying the Libyan rebels. There wasn't a lot of critical coverage of just who are these people really and what's going to happen after Gaddafi.
During Egypt's first uprising in 2011, Al Jazeera was praised for its coverage of Tahrir Square. But the way it handled this summer's ouster of President Mohamed Morsi damaged the channel's credibility, even prompting the resignation of 22 of its staffers in Egypt.
They were barely covering this huge event, millions of people on the streets. And a lot of people said this was because they've got this pro-Muslim Brotherhood bias.
Another time that Al Jazeera was conspicuously quiet was when protests got a little too close to home, in Qatar's fellow Gulf monarchy of Bahrain. And when the English language channel did air its award-winning documentary about the harsh government crackdown on Bahraini protesters, scheduled rebroadcasts of the program were cancelled.
I don't think that the Qatari government really wanted to establish the precedent that massive street protests in a Gulf country are considered a good thing. A lot of, particularly American journalists, have gone over to Al Jazeera English and felt strongly that it was an independent channel. And this was really the first moment, I think, when a lot of them realized, you know what, this really is a state-owned and operated network, and there are red lines that we can't cross.
I frankly wouldn't be here if I didn't believe that this is an editorially independent media company and channel.
Kate O'Brien, formerly of ABC News, is Al Jazeera America's new president.
I don't think the director general and the board would have asked me to join had they not appreciated and respected editorial independence.
What happens a year from now when you have to report a story that's not positive about the Emir of Qatar? What do you do?
We report the story as a news story.
For O'Brien, having Qatar's backing means access to resources that the rest of the news industry is steadily losing.
We will be able to tell stories from places that our competitors will not be able to.
If you turn on your competitors right now, if you see CNN, MSNBC, Fox, and the kind of wall-to-wall coverage that they have of things like the Jody Arias trial or the George Zimmerman trial. I mean, I could go back years and name countless trials. How are you going to compete when that seems to be what your competitors think an American audience wants?
I disagree with the premise that that is what American audiences want. That is what American audiences have at their disposal to watch. It's a resource issue. It's a lot easier for a cable channel to put up a trial that has essentially pool video rolling all day long. You don't have to be spending money and resources doing other things. We are so lucky in that we have the resources to be able to tap into stories that are happening all over the world and all over the United States.
They'll do that by utilizing the 70 bureaus Al Jazeera has around the world and establishing 12 new bureaus in traditionally undercovered places around the U.S., like Nashville or Detroit.
People who are disaffected by what they are accustomed to seeing on cable news will detect the difference immediately.
Al Jazeera America host Ali Velshi.
They will detect that we are not focusing on those things that they don't think are news. They'll detect that we do not necessarily look for guests who take the most extreme views. They'll detect that we allow more time. We don't have rules that say that story is longer than 2 minutes, it can't go on TV. You will know that it is not the same as Fox and MSNBC and CNN from day one.
But some critics worry it will actually look exactly like CNN.
They seem to have this philosophy that in order to host a show, you have to be a current or former CNN employee, which suggests that what they're really trying to do is replicate the CNN model of being this kind of uncontroversial, offend-nobody approach to the news.
Guardian columnist Glenn Greenwald, who's been a contributor to Al Jazeera's English channel, says the new network appears to be diluting its brand to curry favor with advertisers and cable carriers, like Time Warner, which dropped Current TV as soon as Al Jazeera bought it.
I've heard from lots of people on the inside who work at Al Jazeera that they seem very eager to avoid any kind of perception that they are anti-American or anti-Israel by watering down or outright avoiding the kind of journalism that rings strange to American ears. They also have tried to avoid hiring lots of foreigners or people who look or sound foreign.
Perhaps the most scathing criticism of the network's approach came from one of its own, Marwan Bishara, Al Jazeera English's senior political analyst. He sent a letter to executives at the network saying that the new channel benefits from the Al Jazeera brand and that any attempt to separate it from the greater network insults the intelligence of the American people.
I think it is a sign of a healthy organization that kind of internal discussion is going on. There's a real question about what does Al Jazeera America have to do to survive? None of us want to give up the reputation that Al Jazeera English has earned. But at the same time, we do need to have cable carriage. We do need people to understand that this is a station that will cater to their consuming habits.
I just don't think it's going to work because Al Jazeera already is, by its very name, associated with Muslims and a foreign news outlet. Some segment of the population is always going to regard them as some sort of an enemy force. Anybody who has those kind of biases is never going to watch Al Jazeera, no matter what they do.
Channel President Kate O'Brien doesn't see the Americanization of Al Jazeera as a bad thing. After all, she says, it is a channel for Americans.
So the formats, the talent, the producers will be American. That's why Al Jazeera America is different from Al Jazeera English. That's an international channel. This is an American channel.
Many people at the network told me they're hoping for a Field of Dreams moment here, that if they build that channel, Americans will come. For On the Media, I'm Sara Abdurrahman.
Coming up, unusual ways to tell less told stories, past and present, near and far.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. The William and Flora Hewitt Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. For the first time ever, I punched my zip code into AOL's Patch.com, a network of hyperlocal websites that serve mostly upscale communities. I found that a burglar was caught in flagrante delicto a few blocks north of me, and that MTV, which will be holding its award show at a nearby arena, won't share its crowd control plans with frustrated locals, and that the Carousel in the Park is offering free rides this weekend. Patch, acquired by AOL in June of 2009, now operates about 900 sites. But the company just announced it's cutting nearly half of them and hundreds of staff. Why do we care?
Because of all the plagues on modern journalism, the one that seems to cause the greatest angst in official circles is the squeeze on local reporting. How do we learn about the stuff that affects us day to day? The Wall Street Journal's Keech Hagee said that AOL CEO Tim Armstrong was sure that Patch would both turn around AOL's fortunes and fill that local news gap.
Patch was tied to Tim Armstrong more tightly than any other thing, even more than the Huffington Post acquisition that he did after coming to AOL. He co-founded it, and under some duress last year in the middle of a proxy battle with an angry investor, he promised to make it profitable by the end of this year, kind of come hell or high water, and seen over the last year that he's had to make a lot of tough decisions.
Those tough decisions seem to be playing on him a bit. There's that now famous clip of him actually firing someone during a conference call with, what, 1,000 employees?
Right. That audio has gone viral.
Abel, put that camera down right now. Abel, you're fired. Out.
It was in the middle of a speech about how he wouldn't care about them leaking to the press about Patch that he got rid of someone who was documenting his getting rid of a bunch of people at Patch.
How much money was AOL actually pouring into Patch each year?
Well, that number had been going down over time, but back in 2011, it was $160 million a year.
What was AOL getting for its money?
It was getting local advertising, regional advertising, and some national advertising. It just wasn't getting any of that fast enough to offset the cost. According to ComScore, which doesn't count mobile, Patch drew 11 million unique visitors in July, which was the same number that it drew July of last year. They had started cutting costs, you know, last year, and they admitted that that cost cutting was going to have an effect on the traffic growth.
Some people have criticized this really severe cutting on the grounds that if you try to push this accelerated deadline on profitability with these hyperlocal sites, they never can work. But if given the proper time, maybe they could.
And for that reason, a lot of people say a public company like AOL is not the right place to do something like this. You need to do it with the flexibility that only a private company can bring. Local news is really labor intensive, and the audience that you can pull together for that is never really going to be big enough, at least right now, to support advertising in the way that the current online advertising ecosystem works.
Never, ever, ever?
People are experimenting with new models all the time, but online advertising just doesn't pay very much.
Do you have an inkling of any kind of business model that might work?
Well, I do think that paywalls for local newspapers provide one tiny glimmer of light in an otherwise very dark outlook for local news. For example, Gannett, they've been charging paywalls on their local papers. These are not necessarily big cities, and it seems to be working. Maybe not quite as well as they'd originally hoped, but still a lot better than whatever they were doing before. So there is evidence that people will pay for news about their local community.
Just not enough for AOL's board of directors.
Right.
Thank you very much, Keech.
Thank you.
Keech Hagee is a media reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
The challenge of getting less told stories out to Americans who need them and out to America in general is the bane of market-driven journalism. Back in 1935, Franklin Roosevelt put thousands of people to work under the aegis of the Federal Writers Project to do just that. Among those stories, the recollections of slaves, later voiced in an HBO documentary.
We be playing in the barn, and Jimmy always say to me, "Come on, nigga, let's ride around the farm." I say, "I ain't no nigga." He say, "Yes, you is. My pa paid $200 for you. He bought you for to play with me."
Back in 2008, I spoke to Gerald Hirsch, author of Portrait of America, A Cultural History of the Federal Writers Project. He says that among the writers who collected interviews and information about their own multifarious Americas were Conrad Aiken, Saul Bellow, John Cheever, John Steinbeck,
Ralph Ellison, Richard Wright. The Writers Project was set up to find a program that would employ not only creative writers, but people who had skills beyond doing infrastructure. There were unemployed librarians, lawyers, teachers, and journalists and writers. Most of the people on the project had to come off the relief rolls.
Now, 6,600 people mainly plucked from the relief rolls to do what?
To rediscover America, to give us a new and broader knowledge of the very country we lived in, and not to see it in narrow, exclusive terms of just the dominant culture. The things they concentrated on were the American Guide series, a comprehensive and encyclopedic guide to every state in the Union, but they're also well known for the interviews with former slaves, interviews with textile workers in the South, with the idea of the national office called Introducing America to Americans.
Now, it is conventional wisdom that when the federal bureaucracy gets involved in areas that hitherto had been confined to the free marketplace, that everything pretty much goes wrong. It's hard to imagine that literature would be any exception. How successful was the government in getting their work into the hands of ordinary Americans?
They were very successful in getting the guides into the hands of ordinary Americans because they realized that they were not in the position to really publish books for the public market. And they signed contracts with major publishers of the time. So they were able to get much of that stuff out. The interviews with slave narratives, the first of those did not come out until Benjamin Botkin edited a collection called Lay My Burden Down. And they were available in microfilm at the Library of Congress, but historians didn't get around to using them until the 1960s. When they began to become more interested in the slave's perspective.
Well, the next day the master calls me and tells me, "Woman, I's paying big money for you. You a big portly gal. Rufus is a big portly man. I wants y'all to bring forth portly children. I's put you to live with Rufus for that purpose. Now, if you don't want whipping at the stake, you do what I wants."
If you were the Federal Writers Project czar yourself, how would you deploy the writers and researchers and editors and historians at your disposal to produce what is not produced by the free market of literary ideas?
Well, you know, it's interesting you mention that because at one point the National Endowment for the Humanities under Bill Clinton was headed by William Ferris, who is a folklorist and American studies person. He had in mind grants for regional encyclopedias and state encyclopedias with much of the same idea of rediscovering the diversity we're often unaware of in America, having a record of the lives of people who often get neglected. So I would say that would seem to me a worthwhile thing to do.
You could be describing Studs Terkel's career.
Right.
And he's a veteran of the Federal Writers Project.
Right. Well, one of the things that the people at the Writers Project thought in the national office, and they were more liberal, but they thought that if Americans, through the project and on the project, became in touch with the grassroots and everyday life, defining culture in that way, it would lead to a renaissance in American literature and a revival in American arts that could build on that.
Well, Jerry, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Gerald Hirsch is author of Portrait of America, A Cultural History of the Federal Writers Project.
That's one way to bring untold stories to a wider world. Here's another. For more than two decades, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Paul Salopek has reported all over the world, but never like he is right now. Since January, Salopek has been on what he calls the Out of Eden Walk, retracing the path of our human ancestors across the globe. His 21,000-mile trek, which began in East Africa's Great Rift Valley, will end 7 years from now in Tierra del Fuego, the southernmost tip of South America. Here he is on a boat, which he calls an anti-ark, a floating barnyard, delivering thousands of sheep from Djibouti to Jeddah for slaughter. He smells the ammonia reek of the pens, hears the thrum of the diesel, and catches the song of canaries. It was the morose engineer, wrote Salopek. He sits at his post at night playing songbird recordings over and over on his computer. He says it reminds him of a better world. We have Salopek on the phone from Saudi Arabia. Paul, are you doing this mostly by foot?
If this all works out, above 90% of it will be on foot. But because I'm retracing the path of ancient migrations, our ancestors somehow got across the Red Sea, so I did likewise on a camel boat.
You're reporting in a number of ways, tweeting, dispatching, videos. You have a process, right?
Yeah, what we're doing, it's two levels, actually. One is reporting a little bit like I did as a conventional foreign correspondent, whereas I stumble across stories en route. I report those, whether it's in a village or in a city or out in the desert somewhere. But there's a more methodical template as well, and that is every 100 miles I stop and take what I'm calling a narrative milestone or a core sample, if you will, where I'm recording using multimedia what the surface of the Earth looks and sounds like at that particular geocoded spot. And I'll be doing it for 21,000 miles across the world.
Can you give us a taste of that?
Yeah. I was walking with camels through the Rift Valley of Ethiopia, and one of these milestones happen to occur next to a highway. So, ironically, you have imagery of Afar nomads, some of whom are carrying daggers, with camels in the background, and the sound turns out to be a steady stream of trucks. It's kind of string of the Anthropocene, the modern human-made world, providing ambient sound, the throb of tires on asphalt.
And what's it supposed to add up to?
It'll be a record, like beads along a string, of what the world looks like along the path of our ancestors from Africa through Asia all the way down into the tip of South America. The oldest stories we tell ourselves, going back in most cultures, are journey stories, the quest stories. And as a foreign correspondent, I was doing this, but in a pointillist fashion. I'd do a dab of a story here, get on a plane, and do another dab over here. And what I finally was able to concoct with this idea was a single linear narrative that connects all the stories that I've written in the past and stories that I can't even imagine in the future into a single journey story. And by slowing down, the idea is to be able to immerse myself in the headlines in a way that a conventional foreign correspondent often can't.
How have you immersed yourself into the story?
I'll just give you an example. I walked up through the Rift Valley of Africa. That is a combat zone. It's a scene of a resource war between two ethnic pastoral groups, the Afar and the Issa. I noticed as we were walking, Brooke, across this, to my eye, featureless landscape, salt flats stretching as far as the eye could see, my Afar friends who were walking with me were doing S-curves, stretching over miles. And I would ask them, I say, why are we doing this? I've got a GPS, we can go straight to Well X or Oasis Y. And they looked at me as if I was stupid, because what they were walking along were invisible boundaries of conflict that only they and their enemies could see. And that gave me an appreciation about invisible borders that conventional reporters don't see.
That's remarkable. Do you feel at any point that you may get involved in a story?
I feel like I've managed to function best in the storyteller's mode. You know, you are kind of like a blank slate when you're a walker coming into a village or a town. It's remarkable. People spill their stories to you because they can't really share it with neighbors. They see you as a neutral party. They see you as somebody who's safe. When people moved way back and told stories the way I am now, kind of ambulatory storytelling, whether it was Greek bards or West African griots, they had a special status the way traders did, where you sort of left them alone. You didn't bother them because they were bringing a commodity to you. And I'm hoping to tap into that tradition. So if I start becoming a participant in the story, then I might lose part of the story.
What part of the upcoming trip scares you the most?
I would have to break it down. I think there's a physical plane. There are landscapes that are bloody hard to move through, even in a mechanized fashion, much less on foot. Think about Siberia. That is probably going to be the most physically demanding part. The other thing that's kind of counterintuitive is that people have made comments to me as I've walked out of the Horn of Africa, which is this parched, very economically deprived part of the world, saying, boy, Paul, you're walking through probably the hardest part at the beginning. And I'm having to correct them, because actually it's very congenial to walk through economically deprived parts of the world, because people still walk. So it's actually easier to find walking companions. Hmm. It's easier to find walking trails across a landscape that's shaped by the human foot.
You talked at the beginning of the interview about how we've always loved quest stories. But what's the quest? What's the grail at the end of all of this?
Well, there's a grail for me and hopefully a grail for my readers. For me, very selfishly, I want to improve as a writer. I want to see what slowing down and partaking richly of a story does to my storytelling. And on the part of my readers, my hope is to slow them down as well. Highlight the joys of attentiveness. Highlight the joys of sticking with narratives that might be longer than they're used to, that might have a narrative thread that goes not for 24 hours, but for weeks and even years.
You're not proposing this as a form to replace conventional foreign reporting, right?
You know, I've been asked by colleagues saying, Paul, it's a wonderful idea, it's a wonderful concept, but are you dismissing the need for a TV crew to go rush to a terrorism attack? Of course not. Of course not. I'm not being polemical about this. This, again, is a laboratory for me. But what I am saying is that had we slowed down a bit, increased our attention span a bit with critical stories from the 1980s and 1990s, had we walked, as it were, in quotes, through the refugee camps on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, we may not have had as many crises to report in the early 2000s. I think the reactive drive-by nature of modern journalism is self-defeating because it provides less and less analysis. And we take our eyes off stories that fester and then become a self-perpetuating cycle of crisis reporting.
Paul, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We caught up with Paul Salopek, who's on a 7-year foreign reporting trip retracing the path of our human ancestors out of Africa, sponsored by National Geographic and the Knight Foundation. Just Google Out of Eden Walk to follow along.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Molly Buckley and Olivia Wheats. Their internships end this week, Molly and Olivia, or as I sometimes call you, Olivia and Molly. Thank you very much for your work.
It was a wonderful summer.
And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news and our boss. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.